Good evening, everyone. I'm Lenore Mudu. Welcome to Health Chat. $14 billion US dollars. That's how much is needed to replenish the global fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria for the next three-year cycle. French President Emmanuel Macron recently kicked off an almost year-long effort to meet the $14 billion, ask and replenish the fund for the sixth time through 2021. According to the Global Fund, nearly 1,000 adolescent girls and young women are infected with HIV every day. A child still dies every 2 minutes from malaria. And TB is now the world's leading killer among infectious diseases. Joining us in our studio for more on the subject is Elizabeth Ivanovich. She is Director for Global Health with the UN Foundation. Ms. Ivanovich, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. Well, we'll have our discussion on the Global Fund and what's being done in a moment. But first, here's a report by Carol Pearson on the latest on TB.
Last year, tuberculosis killed more people than any other communicable disease, more than 1.3 million men, women, and children. Yet experts say countries are not providing enough money to contain TB. One UN official said an additional $13 billion per year is needed to get the disease under control. The World Health Organization estimates that 10 million people who become infected each year live mostly in poor countries with limited access to health care. WHO Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus told the Assembly that partnership is vital to end the disease. WHO plans to lead UN efforts to support governments and other partners to drive a faster response to TB. Most patients can be cured with a six-month treatment program, but as world leaders told the Assembly, medication is expensive and the stigma associated with TB interferes with getting people screened and treated. Nandita Venkatesan, a young woman from India, told the gathering about the toll the disease has taken on her life. She got TB more than once, including a drug-resistant variety. Venkatesan said getting cured involved hospital stays, six surgeries, and negative reactions to the medicine that was supposed to cure her. Just days before the high-level meeting, the World Health Organization released its annual TB report. It found cases among all age groups and in all countries. Two-thirds of the cases were in just eight countries: India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, China, Indonesia, the Philippines, South Africa, and Nigeria. The meeting ended with the adoption of a declaration intended to strengthen action and investments for ending TB and saving millions of lives. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
So, Elizabeth, again, thank you for joining us. You heard this report on where we stand with regards to TB, which is one of the diseases that the Global Fund actually addresses. What is your reaction in terms of where we stand with fighting this particular disease?
I think there's a long way to go in terms of dealing with tuberculosis around the world. And as you heard, there are a large number of drug-resistant infections, which is a challenge. And another challenge is that there are many cases that are not detected. So people who have TB are having TB at home and potentially dying of TB at home and infecting others without ever being diagnosed with TB. And that is, I think, about 4 million people a year are undiagnosed with TB and walking around. So that's a huge global health security challenge as well.
Yes, definitely a security challenge, and also a challenge for the patients who really need to have access to the care, you know, the proper care, proper treatment. And one aspect of this access to proper care has to do with funding. And we heard it in the report, money is needed to tackle TB and also malaria and HIV and so many other diseases, but we are focusing on the three because that's what the Global Fund addresses. So talk to us about this $14 billion US dollars. That's an ambitious goal. How much are we going to raise from that?
Well, my hope would be we raise at least $14 billion, and really $14 billion is the floor of funding that the Global Fund needs in order to roll out its strategic plan for AIDS, TB, and malaria and health system strengthening. Mm-hmm. With that $14 billion, it's projected that 16 million lives can be saved and 234 million infections can be averted. So, you know, the return on investment here is incredible and has been estimated to be $19 for every $1 invested.
Mm-hmm. And this is the sixth term for replenishment. Since the fund has been around, what has been accomplished?
A huge amount has been accomplished, and I would say number one is that 27 million people's lives have been saved by funding from the Global Fund in countries mm-hmm. where the Global Fund invests.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about this and we talk numbers, right, concretely on the ground, how are people seeing this big amount of money in their communities?
So how are they
perceiving? How does this trickle down in communities?
So the Global Fund invests in technically sound plans created by countries, and it's really a group of stakeholders in each country that come together to put together plans for AIDS, TB, and malaria. And once that plan is approved, then funding goes to the country, and it's a country-led response. So generally, the health system gets some of that funding, but also there are smaller grantees at lower levels. I've visited with some grantees. For example, I went to a place in South Africa where sex workers were receiving training on other vocations and on their own rights. And so you see, even at the kind of very, very community level, that the funding from the Global Fund is reaching there and making a difference in people's lives.
Because sometimes people say, you know, there's this big money that comes out, you know, the global community raises funds, private, public institutions come together in solidarity to tackle issues. But sometimes people say they don't see, or disbursement is a problem, you know, they don't see where the money goes, or they don't get as much as needed on the ground. So it's really good to have those stories to see exactly how communities are benefiting from the money. So you talked to us about some of the impact that we have seen. So what about some challenges when it comes to replenishing the fund itself? I know that the U.S. is the largest donor for the fund. How is this replenishment cycle being impacted when we look at concerns from people that there might be some cuts?
Well, the Global Fund is fortunate to have had a long-standing bipartisan support in the U.S. Congress since its founding in 2002. Congress, which is responsible for the U.S. budget, has recently signaled that they will continue to support the Global Fund, recognizing that resources need to grow in the next replenishment. So the last replenishment was $13 billion approximately, mm-hmm. and this one is $14 billion. So that's a 15% increase. Mm. So it's... you know, ambitious, but not so sizable that we can't reach that goal.
That's encouraging. So far, the goals have been met?
So far, the goals have been approximately met. So, mm-hmm. you know, maybe $100 million fall short.
Yeah.
The last time around, the replenishment came in at $12.9 billion. And then additional funds have come in the last 3 years that go to that replenishment round as well.
Mm-hmm. So when we look at the Sustainable Development Goal 3, which is health and well-being, really, and the Global Fund is one of the tools to help reach that goal. What is needed to achieve this goal? Is it even realistic?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say our success or failure in reaching the target of ending the three epidemics by 2030 will be one of the clearest tests of the world's commitment to the Sustainable Development Goals. We saw tremendous progress against AIDS, TB, and malaria during the Millennium Development Goals, and our ability to sustain these gains and build on them will be a test of our commitment to sustainability itself. Across the three diseases, we are at a really critical juncture. We're currently not on track to reaching the majority of the 2020 targets related to these diseases. Mm-hmm. If we don't step up the fight now, it will become extremely difficult to reach the final 2030 targets. Mm-hmm. So kind of in a broader sense, other health issues are facing challenges also in reaching the ambitious targets that were set for the SDGs. And in order to achieve these targets and the ambitious goal of health and well-being for all, health systems need to be strengthened to address the spectrum of health issues. The Global Fund is currently the largest multilateral investor in health systems, investing $4 billion every 3 years. And these investments are strengthening data systems, training health workers, improving supply chain and procurement mechanisms, and providing diagnostic tools. So investments in health systems, that helps all boats rise together.
Yeah. And you mentioned health systems, such a critical factor in this big picture, because even if there is money coming in the country, if there is no infrastructure or even the qualified personnel, then there is a problem. So let's talk a little more about the different areas. When you talked about strengthening health system, let's talk a little more about the different aspects that you mentioned. For example, you talked about, I think, data. Mm-hmm. It's part of it. So what are we looking at in terms of data? Data collection, improving data collection, or data keeping? What are we looking at?
So I think it's all aspects of data. It's from collection to use. And I think use is the real critical thing that we're trying to get at here, right?
Okay.
Because we want people to use data to make decisions, not to just use their guts to do that.
Yes.
And so what we see is that the Global Fund investing in data systems are investing in systems that can be used across the health system. They're being used by vaccination programs and maternal and child health programs. And really, they're getting into the 21st century. Whereas, 15 years ago, you would go into a health directorate in Africa and people didn't even have a computer. Right. Mm. So now you're getting to the point where people have computers, people have tablets where they're using them for data collection, and then they have automated tools where they can see, oh, well, there's a spike in cases of cholera or malaria or HIV in this area of the country. And then they can actually respond to that, because before we were really flying blind.
Yes, yes, yes. And also another aspect that you mentioned is, I think, training. Let's talk about training. I think it's so important. Capacity building. What are we looking at? What is being done, for example?
So I think that there's a huge amount of investment going into training health workers, and that's across the spectrum. So it could be primary healthcare workers. It's lab technicians, and I think a lot of specialized skills that hadn't existed before. Mm-hmm. And then it's also longer-term training programs that are happening in institutions. So there have been training programs that have been developed using Global Fund funding, mm-hmm. where Global Fund funds certain personnel to go and take a university course, and okay. universities are kind of building programs to meet the health system's needs in Africa.
Interesting. And so how do countries take ownership of this, of their chunk of the the funds, if you will? How does this work?
Well, I think countries are already owning this. They own the Global Fund process because they put forward an application to the Global Fund mm-hmm. with a country-led approach. But in reality, domestic investments in health far outpace development assistance for health, and they're mm-hmm. continuing to grow. And the $14 billion replenishment of the Global Fund is expected to spur domestic investment of upwards of $46 billion.
Okay.
So we can see that national governments are investing more in their own health systems than development assistance for health is.
That's good to know that countries are taking ownership of their own, health system and doing as much as I can, and I believe maybe needs to be done, whether it's on the country level or on community level even. And how do community get involved in all this? For example, when it comes to malaria, tackling malaria, in a given community, what kind of program? Can you give us an example of a program that could be implemented, or perhaps the UN Foundation is spearheading?
Yeah, so I think at community level, treatment is really important as well as prevention. So communities can get involved by ensuring that they are covered by preventive programs like distribution of bed nets or spraying. Mm-hmm. But I think even more, it's in terms of community case management of malaria and other febrile illnesses. So it is important in places that are malaria endemic, where there is a lot of malaria, for there to be some sort of health worker located in the community, so that if a child gets sick in the middle of the night with a fever, then they can be tested and treated in the community. And that's been going on for a decade or more and really has transformed the response to malaria.
Okay, that's great. And speaking of malaria, we will have a report on malaria in a few moments, but it's time to take a break and we will go to the news. And after that, we will continue our discussion with Elizabeth, with the UN Foundation. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Thank you, Lenore. The U.S.-based Carter Center says Guinea worm disease could soon be wiped out. The non-governmental organization founded by the former President Jimmy Carter says there are about 3.5 million human cases of Guinea worm disease in Africa and Asia every year before 1986. However, just 28 human cases of Guinea worm disease were reported last year, 17 cases in Chad, 10 in South Sudan, and 1 in Angola. People and animals get Guinea worm disease from drinking contaminated water. The disease is rarely fatal, but can incapacitate victims for months. There is no vaccine against the disease and no medicine to treat it, but the disease can be easily prevented by drinking clean water or filtered water and keeping Guinea worm patients and animals away from water sources. A new report by the World Health Organization disputes a belief that refugees and migrants bring exotic communicable diseases into the European region. The report is based on evidence from more than 13,000 documents. It provides a snapshot of the health of refugees and migrants, who comprise about 10% of the nearly 1 billion people in 53 European countries. The survey finds migrants and refugees are generally in good health, but due to poor living conditions, they risk falling ill while in transit or while staying in receiving countries. The report says that, contrary to common perception, the risk of refugees and migrants transmitting communicable diseases to their host population is very low. The report says that refugees and migrants are more affected by depression and anxiety than host populations. And that's a wrap-up of your latest health news.
Welcome back. For those of you joining us late, tonight we are discussing funding the Global Fund to Fight HIV, Malaria, and TB. And our guest is Elizabeth Ivanovich. She is Director for Global Health with the UN Foundation. Before we continue our discussion, here is the latest on malaria with VOA's Steve Baragona.
Malaria cases are down 60% since 2000, thanks to multi-billion dollar global efforts. But the battle is not over, says Frank Kloperga at University College London.
More than 400,000 people are killed every year by malaria, and actually most of them are small children below 5 years of age in the sub-Saharan regions in Africa.
The best, most widely used treatment is a three-day course of pills combining two drugs, artemether and lumefantrine. But most drug trials have not included children and pregnant women, who may absorb or metabolize medicines differently. Kloperga says children have different levels of key enzymes, for example.
Pregnant women also have changes in body composition. You can think about water and fat content. And this also has an impact on how the drug distributes through the body.
Some studies have found children and pregnant women are more likely than others to develop malaria again within weeks of treatment. Writing in the journal PLOS Medicine, Kloperga and colleagues combined data from 31 studies, which included more than 4,000 patients. They looked at blood levels of lumefantrine 7 days after treatment began.
Pregnant women were, for example, 20% lower, and depending on the body weight group in children, it was somewhere between 15 and 25% lower.
He says that raises the risk not only that treatment will fail, but also that resistance will develop. Malaria parasites exposed to lower levels of the drug may survive treatment and produce resistant strains. Kloperga and colleagues developed a model that suggests taking the pills for 5 days would be more effective than the current 3-day schedule. It's an important, well-done study, says Andrea Bosman, malaria prevention, diagnosis, and treatment coordinator at the World Health Organization. However, he adds,
it is still a modeling study, and we do not generally make recommendations based on modeling studies alone. We require clinical data.
And Bosman says longer treatment carries its own risks.
It has a downfall in terms of adherence to treatment, because the more you ask the people to take, the less becomes the compliance.
Less compliance means more treatment failure and more risk of resistance. Other studies have not concluded that changing treatment is necessary. Kloeperga and colleagues are applying for funding to conduct a clinical trial of the 5-day treatment schedule. It'll be several years before results are in. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
So, Elizabeth, you heard this report. When we look at the Global Fund, how much is research part of the fund's disbursement?
Well, the Global Fund relies heavily on research and development of products. So I think their role is mainly in getting those products out to field. Mm-hmm. So they really rely on the development of new diagnostic tests. They're looking into the development of a malaria vaccine and how they might help fund that. But I think further down the line, in terms of research and development, they rely on other partners to put forward investments in that.
Mm-hmm. So how do we make the case to partners to invest in the Global Fund? Well, I mean, so far it's been very successful. So how do they respond to the importance of this fund?
I think that partners around the world recognize the importance of the Global Fund, and many of these partners got involved in the early 2000s when the AIDS epidemic seemed completely out of control and, you know, hospital wards were full of AIDS, TB, and malaria patients. And so they're committed. I think that they, you know, a lot of people have personal experience with people that they care about who were affected by the three diseases. And so that solidarity that people have had has lasted for, at this point, 17 years. And we do rely on continued solidarity in this effort. While we're not in an emergency situation anymore, we are at a point where all three diseases are seeing a bit of backsliding, and more investment is going to be needed in order to reach the 2030 goals.
Mm-hmm. And what do you see in terms of some of the challenges? I know that you talked about how successful it's been so far to achieve the funding goal, at least get close to it. But what are the current challenges when we look at the climate globally?
Mm-hmm. I think the global economy will be a big indicator of how much countries are able to provide. Since 2008, when the global financial crisis occurred, there has been a plateauing of development assistance for health. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of the reason that domestic financing has increased significantly. Mm-hmm. And part of that has been because of the incredible growth in lower and middle income countries' economies that has enabled investment. And I would say part of that growth is in response to the success of the Global Fund and other global health investments that have occurred.
What do you see as some priorities moving forward?
The other priorities moving forward?
Mm-hmm. We found the fund, or at least to meet the SDGs 3.
So I think investing in health systems is a big priority of the Global Fund. Addressing the issue of HIV and AIDS among adolescent girls and young women in southern and eastern Africa is critical in order to control the HIV epidemic. And I think other priorities include just increasing the efficiency of the investment that we already have. So $14 billion alone is not enough to address the three diseases. That needs to be combined with investments from countries and other donors, like the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief and the President's Malaria Initiative from the U.S. So I think the priorities are working better together, having better investments, seeing what works through the data and sharing of data with partners. And I think, you know, through the new leadership of the Global Fund under Peter Sands, who joined us about a year ago, the Global Fund really has a lot of prospect to be innovative and take a new approach that will lead to more efficiencies.
Okay. Now you are the director for global health with the UN Foundation. So we're going to move away a little bit from the Global Fund and turn to what you do on a daily basis. What are some of the programs or maybe priorities that the UN Foundation is looking at in terms of global health?
Well, we're looking at a lot of different priorities. We do have programs that are focused on vaccine-preventable diseases and malaria, and so we do provide investments in those spaces, primarily in sub-Saharan Africa. Our malaria investments are focused on displaced people, so including refugees and internally displaced people, because that's an area where a lot of governments are not investing and a lot of partners are not investing. So we feel it's an important gap to fill. With our immunization programs, we are partnering with Walgreens to donate a number of different vaccines around the world. And then in addition to that, we host a number of partnerships like the Family Planning 2020 partnership, which is trying to increase access to family planning, and the Clean Cooking Alliance, which is helping the world approach cooking in a different way so that we are using less fossil fuels, which cause air pollution and damage to human health as well.
Interesting. So what should we look forward to this new year with some of the programs, perhaps some new initiatives that you're coming up with or reinforcing some initiatives that are already existing?
So I think this year is going to be an exciting year. I mean, we are working closely with the Global Fund on its replenishment. There are a number of other replenishments for other health partners like Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, that are upcoming, and the Global Polio Eradication Initiative, which we are also a partner of. And so we will be working on advocacy and making sure that the world knows that these funding replenishments are happening and that they need to reach out to their representatives to let them know that they're supportive of global health, and in particular this year, the Global Fund.
Why is it important to invest in health, in global health?
Well, global health is one of the best investments that exists. So just a couple of days ago, Bill Gates put out an article in the Wall Street Journal saying how global health is the best investment that he has ever made, and that other investments, you know, if he had invested during the time he's invested $10 billion in the Global Fund and Gavi and GPEI, that the same amount invested in the S&P would have gotten him a 17% return. But with the Global Fund investment and the Gavi investment and other investments, it's been about a 20-to-1 return on investment, and that's really unheard of in markets. And that's the way that countries build their economies.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes we hear this from some countries where they're saying, you know, we have so many investment priorities, or we have this issue to tackle, we have that issue to tackle. So how do they pick and choose what's important? How do they pick and choose what the priority is? So when you look at, for example, HIV, TB, and malaria, and we talk about investing in the three diseases, how is the Global Fund disbursing in between the three?
So the Global Fund's investment is 50% to HIV, 32% to malaria, and 18% to TB. And then within that, there's a lot of health systems investments that are made as well.
Mm-hmm. And so let's look at the next 5 years. If we were to be optimistic in terms of achieving the 2030 SDGs goal, what would you say? Really, I know we talked about priorities earlier, but if you would want to kind of go over it a little bit in terms of where we should focus on.
So I'm just going to go back to health systems. I do also think that research and development is really important, because right now we don't have the tools that we need to end the three diseases. And we rely on research and development partners to create those tools. And so we're talking about, can we have a vaccine for malaria, for HIV? Mm-hmm. Can there be a kind of long-acting cure or medication for HIV? Are there better ways to deliver TB treatment? So I think that those investments are going to be really important, and the Global Fund, I think, is ready and willing to take them up as soon as they are approved by the World Health Organization.
And to find out more about the UN Foundation and the work you do?
You can visit our website. It is www.unfoundation.org.
Elizabeth Ivanovic, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have. We thank our guest, Elizabeth Ivanovic, Director for Global Health with the UN Foundation. For more on the show, check us out on facebook.com/VOA Health Chat. Thanks to all of you for joining us, and thanks to all our affiliates. A shout out to Unity Radio FM 90.
This is VOA News.